When I was a little boy growing up in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania, we had thousands and thousands of chestnut trees in the area. We used to throw the chestnuts at each other for fun, and our parents would gather them and roast them as a snack. But then disease struck the American chestnut population. I haven't seen a chestnut tree in decades. They're almost all gone. Scientists now say that they've come up with a plan to revive the American chestnut through genetic engineering. To some, that might sound like a great idea. But is it? It's never been done before, and we have literally no idea what it will do to other trees as its pollen is spread by the winds, bees, and other insects. Are we saving the American chestnut, or are we dooming other species? I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Scientists have been working for years to revive the American chestnut, a large tree that once covered the eastern part of the country and provided food for humans and animals alike. The tree usually lived for hundreds of years and made up an important part of the eastern American tree canopy. But beginning in the early 20th century, the tree was affected by something called chestnut blight, a fungal disease that came from the invasive Japanese chestnut. Beginning in 1904 and spanning the entirety of the 20th century, it is estimated that the blight killed between 4 and 6 billion American chestnut trees. Now only stumps and root systems remain. They produce young saplings, which are almost immediately infected with chestnut blight, and then they die. There are now only between 600 and 800 American chestnut trees that survive, and they're all in the northern part of the state of Michigan. Several groups of scientists are working to revive the American chestnut, including a group at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry. Those scientists had the idea to insert the oxalate oxidase gene from wheat into the DNA of the American chestnut to degrade the oxalic acid produced by chestnut blight. In 2021, these scientists asked government permission to introduce the newly genetically modified trees into the wild. That's great, right? Well, no, actually, it's not great. First, we have no idea what the environmental impact will be of producing a genetically modified tree into nature. It's never been done before. And even if we had an idea of what would happen, we still don't know what would happen 50, 100, even 200 years from now. Remember, these trees live for centuries. And perhaps most disturbingly, these same scientists recently made a very serious mistake. Instead of using something called D58 to pollinate trees in their research plots, they accidentally used something called D54, which has OXO DNA in a different part of its genome. Almost all of the thousands of test trees are D54s, not D58s. Again, we have literally no idea what the effect will be. We're happy to welcome a guest today who is an expert on this important environmental issue. Ann Peterman is executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, which she co-founded in 2003. She's also the co-founder and international coordinator of the Campaign to Stop GE Trees. Ann, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on, John.
Wow, Ann, there aren't many issues that I know nothing about and then 5 minutes after starting to look into them, become a true believer, like I did on this issue. So, Ann, let's start with the nature of this problem. Tell us about the American chestnut, about its coverage a century ago, about what happened to it, and why its destruction has been almost complete.
Sure. Yeah, the American chestnut was a tree, as you mentioned earlier, that dominated the canopy of the eastern United States. An estimated 1 in 4 trees in many places were these huge American chestnuts, some of which were 15 feet in diameter or more. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, they provided a lot of the food for wildlife. They provided a lot of the food for humans, especially in Appalachia, who sold the chestnuts, who used them for their pigs and other wildlife. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Livestock. And then, as you mentioned, around 1900, these Japanese chestnuts were imported into New York City and they had this blight on them, this chestnut blight, as it's been known, which rapidly spread because it's a fungus with very small spores. The spores rapidly spread throughout the chestnut forests, and all but a few were killed by this blight. Although at the same time, I have to admit that there was a response to the blight, people trying to save the wood that was left, if you will.
Ah, right.
And so there was a huge logging campaign that happened. So people were both trying to create a firebreak of sorts to stop the spread of the fungus, and they were also trying to salvage log, I guess you could say, and take out the trees before they were killed. So it's hard to know how many trees were killed by the blight and how many trees were killed by this overlogging response to the blight. But either way, the chestnut population was quite decimated. Although there are some millions left in the forest, and there are even large surviving American chestnuts that another group known as the American Chestnut Cooperators Foundation is using to try to breed wild American chestnuts with some blight resistance.
When did the work actually begin to try to save the American chestnut? When was it that people realized, oh my God, this is worse than we thought, it's getting out of hand? And what did that work entail? Was it just cutting down to make something of a firewall to try to save those trees? It didn't always include genetic modification, of course.
No. Genetic modification has only been added to the mix in the last few decades. Mm. Prior to that, people used all kinds of different techniques. You know, when the science of the problem was quite young, people were experimenting. They really didn't know what to do. They were quite desperate because of the rapid pace of the spread of the disease and how virulent it was to the American chestnut. So a lot of different experimental measures were taken, mm-hmm. and from everything from breeding the surviving American chestnuts that were left to interbreeding the American chestnuts with blight-resistant Chinese chestnuts and using the hybrids and seeing if they would survive, and a variety of other tactics. But the one that probably got the most attention up until the genetic engineering took over was the hybridization between the American chestnuts and the Chinese chestnuts. And there's been decades of work on that as well.
What exactly is genetic modification in this context, and why do scientists spend so much time working on it rather than focusing on something like hybridization or trying to attack the fungus that is spread by the Japanese chestnut?
Sure. Well, there is actually an attempt to deal with the fungus itself in a process called hypovirulence, where actually trying to make the fungus itself less virulent. And so that is another area that is being looked at, although it's another area that hasn't had a lot of success. The hybridization has had a lot of success, but the problem is they're great orchard trees, they're great for producing edible chestnuts, but they're not great for putting into forests for a whole variety of reasons, one of which is they just don't compete. They're very short trees, they're very, kind of stocky, but they don't grow tall, and so they can't compete with native trees in the forest.
And what's the role of government in all this? Is government a neutral observer, or is it pushing a solution involving genetic modification?
The government is not so much pushing the genetic modification process as it is permitting it, kind of looking the other way and letting it go in a way that's not responsible. And actually, there was a study on the use of genetic engineering in forest restoration or protection of forests that the National Academy of Sciences did in 2018. And what they found was that the regulatory agencies in the United States are completely unequipped to deal with something like genetically engineered trees. They have no experience. This is understanding how genetic engineering will impact trees will take decades, right? You have to let the full life cycle of the tree take place. You have to let the tree have offspring, see what happens to them. It's a very long process, and the government's not interested in dealing with that long process. The companies aren't interested in dealing with that long process. The researchers aren't interested in dealing with that long process. Mm-hmm. So they really just expedite the process and make it very unsafe.
Tell us a little bit, too, about cooperation between scientists, between universities or environmental centers. Is there cooperation, or are we stovepiping these efforts to try to save this tree?
There is definitely cooperation among the universities and some of the NGOs. The American Chestnut Foundation, for example, has been in a very close partnership with the State University of New York's College of Environmental Science and Forestry in the development of this genetically engineered American chestnut tree with a lot of corporate support. So don't leave out the corporate support. Huh. ESF in SUNY has gotten a lot of money from and technical support, both money and technical support from Monsanto, from ArborGen, from Duke Energy. You know, there's been a lot of corporate backing of this genetically engineered American chestnut, both because it's a way to get the public more excited about the idea of genetically engineered trees, because it's not supposedly a tree for industry, but a tree for forest restoration. And in that, it allows the doors to be opened to all of these corporate controlled and corporate design trees, if you will, for plantations, for timber, for biomass, for even biofuels.
Okay, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we are going to continue our conversation with Ann Peterman about the threat that genetically modified trees could cause to the environment, as well as the possibility that the American chestnut can actually be revived. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
За спиной ту-ту-ту-ту-ту, вот эта вот очередь автоматная.
И сразу так мысль, тюм, все, убили.
Обернулся, увидел людей, которые все еще находились рядом со мной. Всем крикнул за мной и побежал на улицу.
Все уходите в ту сторону, туда, 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 туда.
Там герой был каждый.
Но он мне вслед прокричал, и я буду молиться за вас.
Все объединились, и я думаю, что если бы наши люди были не такие, то жертв было бы гораздо больше.
У нас очень сочувственный народ, который всю беду всегда через себя пропускает.
Душа болит, сердце болит. Ну как это не попрощаться с людьми, которые погибли как здесь?
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Ann Peterman. She's the executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, which she co-founded in 2003. She's also the co-founder and international coordinator of the Campaign to Stop GE Trees. Ann, thanks again for being with us. It's good to have you.
Thank you so much.
Ann, can you explain to us what the process of genetic modification is for trees? It seems like it has to be done in a completely closed environment, which of course is a good thing, but then is it just all released into the environment? Doesn't that defeat the purpose?
The genetic engineering of trees is following on the tradition of genetically engineering crops. Mm. And many of the same traits that are being engineered into trees are things that have been done in crops since about the 80s. It's all done in a lab, and it involves various techniques for inserting, in the case of the American chestnut, inserting genes from a completely unrelated species, a grass, barley, into the American chestnut to create the genetically engineered American chestnut. So the very, very process of genetic modification is very disruptive to the genome. So they're going in there and they're using either a bacterium in this case, or in some cases, literally DNA-coded little bullets that they fire into the cell, and they hope that it lands somewhere useful in the genome, on one of the chromosomes, so that they can then have a product that can be tested out, that can be replicated, that can be eventually put out into the field. So in the case of the GE chestnut, in around 2017, they had some American chestnut seedlings that were to the point that they could put them outside of the greenhouse, outside of the lab, and out into the environment. And it was only 3 years later, only 3 years after being in the field, that they asked the government for permission to release these things into our wild forests with no requirements for monitoring or regulating them anymore. So they could, you know, once they're out into the forest, there would be no way to track them, no way to know where they've gone. And if something went wrong, which it did, there would have been no way to call them back. So it was really a disaster waiting to happen, which is one of the reasons that we were so actively opposing it and why we rallied so many people to oppose it with us.
One of the important issues, and this is a great segue into the next question. One of the important issues that you raise in your talks is that the lifespan of these trees can be hundreds of years. So if we studied the trees for 10 years or even 20 years, we still have literally no idea what the long-term effects will be of releasing them into the environment. What is it, do you think, we should be afraid of here? Is it that they may come to dominate other species? Is it that they may harm other species or overtake them? Is it that they may spread disease that we haven't thought of yet to another species?
Well, in the case of trees, trees are not like crop plants, which you've pointed out in the show, you know, before. They are species that live for potentially centuries, decades, if not centuries, and they interact with other species in a forest ecosystem. Already we know very little about forest ecosystems, you know, the mycorrhizal fungus communities and how they interact with the trees and how the trees communicate with each other and, right, you know, all of these really incredibly complicated interactions. And now you're going to be putting into this ecosystem a tree that's never existed before, a tree that has a transgene from barley that does things that trees have never done before, and pretending to know that, to understand that you know what will happen. And literally, it is genetic engineering causes unpredictable impacts. And the fact that they're unpredictable in a crop plant is bad enough. But when you have these unpredictable impacts in a tree that you've now released into the forest, to spread these unpredictable impacts in a way that can't be reversed is obviously a disaster waiting to happen.
And should we expect there to be some sort of a change in the chestnut itself? Could this potentially have an effect on animals that would eat the chestnuts?
It could have a lot of different effects. So the genetically engineered trait that was engineered into the American chestnut did in fact have a very significant impact on that tree, not when it was younger, not when they were asking the USDA to deregulate it, but later, 7 years later, in fact, it suddenly started turning brown. It was dying. It was growing very slowly, 20% slowly, the non-engineered chestnuts. It wasn't even resistant to the blight that it was engineered to resist. Oh. So what ended up happening was the American Chestnut Foundation found out that, oops, you know, we actually have the wrong GE tree here, as you mentioned, the D54, not the D58. But then later they explained that, in fact, the way that any of that darling line, the D stands for darling, the way that any of that darling line had been transformed, it was bound to have this impact because the promoter, quote unquote, that they used to turn the gene on made sure that the gene was on all the time. And so that ended up having a tremendous metabolic effect on the tree that caused it to die in large numbers or turn brown or be stunted. So in fact, the genetic modification was very destructive to the tree itself, not to mention all of the other species. And just getting back to what you were asking about what the impacts would be on those other species, we really don't know. In the petition by these researchers from SUNY ESF, they said that they had done experiments to see what the impacts would be on pollinators. But in fact, they didn't have any pollen from the tree that they were asking for deregulation, the D58. So they used non-transgenic pollen, which they mixed with OXO purified from barley. And they said that that's the same thing. If you mix up the barley and the barley OXO and the pollen from a non-transgenic tree, it's the same thing as if it was genetically engineered. So, you know, they weren't even using the same material. And they were saying, using that to say this is safe for pollinators. And obviously, all of us are very concerned about what's happening to pollinators worldwide with the, you know, the major declines in population. This could be another nail in their coffin.
Oh, my goodness. And I want to dig down a little deeper into this lab error that occurred in 2021. The media are saying that it was such a significant mistake that it set the research back by decades. So can you explain what happened, this difference between D54 and D58? And what's the effect of that mistake, either in the short term vis-a-vis the setback or over the long term?
Sure. Yeah. So sometime around 2016, the researchers from the American Chestnut Foundation received GE tree material from the State University of New York, and it was supposed to be the D58, okay, which was the transgenic event, they call them events, that they had settled on as being the best chance for resisting the blight. You know, for the American chestnut to resist this chestnut blight. And so the ESF turned over this material to TACF to propagate it, to cross it with wild American chestnuts and do various experiments with it and see where it grew the best and so forth. And what ended up happening is last December, TACF announced that they had been given the wrong material way back in 2016.
Wow.
So for 7 years, they were using the wrong material and didn't even know it. So they had been given these D54 trees, which have the same OXO gene, but inserted on a different chromosome. And it turns out the fact that it was on the wrong chromosome made it more lethal to the trees.
Oh my goodness. And
so they didn't know about it for 7 years. And what really has been the thing that's stood out for me from all of this is that it showed that the researchers really didn't know what they were doing this entire time. Even the researchers themselves have said, well, it was a learning process and we didn't really have the, you know, the equipment to know what was going on at the time. And, you know, it wasn't until after they started to die that we really looked into it and then figured it out and blah, 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 blah. You know, and to me that says, okay, you asked in 2020 to release these trees into the forest, unregulated, unmonitored, and you didn't even know what was going on. And it wasn't for three more years that the trees started going belly up that you finally figured out, oh, hey, maybe these aren't the best idea. You know, and that does not inspire confidence. You know, these people say that they know what they're doing and, you know, we can trust them, but clearly that's not the case.
Who do these scientists report to at the end of the day? Is there some sort of environmental oversight? Is this the Department of Agriculture, the Environmental Protection Agency? Who do they answer to at the end of the day?
The release of the genetically engineered American chestnut into the environment requires the permission of the USDA. So it's a part of the agency which is called the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service. So APHIS has to approve these GE trees. They have to go through an environmental assessment, an environmental impact statement, depending on the species. In this case, an environmental impact statement, before they can be released into the environment. In the case of the chestnut, because it's also has this antifungal property, it needs to be also regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency. That's a whole different set of regulations and rules that they have to deal with. Because it's also a food, it also needs regulation by the Food and Drug Administration, although that's actually voluntary. The researchers are going through that, but it's actually voluntary. They don't need to do it, but they say they're doing it. So it's very complicated. But the thing that, as I get back to, according to the National Academy of Sciences, none of these agencies actually have any tools or experience or knowledge in how to judge whether these genetically engineered trees would be safe for forests. And that's what really it comes down to. But since all of this has happened, the USDA has changed their biotechnology regulations. And now they really don't exist. I mean, they exist on paper, but basically, right, it's almost a self-reporting. The industry can now decide if their genetically engineered product should be regulated or not before it goes through the process. So, you know, I don't know how many Monsantos out there are going to go, oh, yes, please regulate me. So it's really gotten much worse since this. And this was not good, but now it's gotten even worse.
So where do we stand now? We know that scientists made this grievous mistake in 2016. The mistake lasted for years. The tree doesn't do what the scientists told us it was going to do. Is the whole process ongoing? Is it over? Are they starting back from the beginning again? What's this look like?
Well, in the case of the researchers at SUNY ESF in New York, they have decided that they still want these trees deregulated. So even though the petition is for the D58 tree, and these are in fact not D58 trees, these are D54 trees and have all of these problems that we just been discussing, they still want them deregulated by the US government. And the reason they want them deregulated is because the way the rules work, once this tree is deregulated, any other trees using the same genetic construct will be automatically deregulated. So even if the D58 and the D54 don't work, maybe the D59 or the D624, I don't know, maybe one of those will work. So they're still trying to get these trees deregulated. But on the other side, the American Chestnut Foundation, the other major GE tree proponents, are saying, you know, actually, the darling line, the D line of these trees is not the way we need to be going, and we need to start looking at different ways to genetically engineer the trees. In both cases, we're quite disappointed. You know, here's a great opportunity to learn, to say, hey, you know, we tried this genetic engineering thing. We really didn't know what we were doing. It did not work at all in the long run, and maybe we should say that genetic engineering is perhaps not the best tool for going into forests and dealing with wild forest ecosystems, because we really don't know what's going to happen. And unfortunately, that's not what's happening. Both groups are moving ahead with more genetic engineering of trees, and I think that's really unfortunate.
Ann Peterman, thank you so much for explaining this to us. You know, these important issues so often fly under the radar and are not covered in the mainstream media, and this is one of those very critical, crucial, long-term issues. Thanks for educating us. The American cultural anthropologist and author Margaret Mead once said, quote, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has," unquote. And the environment is where we all meet. It's where we all have a mutual interest. It's the one thing that we all share. We have to get it right or it'll be our demise. It's wonderful that scientists want to save the American chestnut. I think it's a great idea. But remember the old proverb, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Thank you to Ann Peterman for joining us today and for sharing her expertise. And thank you to our viewers for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.